Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KALW's radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. I'll be joined virtually today by the artistic director of the general director of the Opera San Jose, Corey Dastour. Eric Zivian and Tanya Tompkins will talk about the happenings of the Valley of the Moon Festival and what musicians are doing to cope during this crisis. We'll also hear from the San Francisco Chronicle's music critic, Joshua Cosman. He'll be sharing what he's been doing and not doing. Peter Robinson offers some classic movie musicals for at-home diversion. And it's Shakespeare Week. He died on this date in 1616, and Sunday is his birthday. So I'll ask my guests what Shakespeare means to them, and perhaps they'll share their favorite Shakespeare. Stay with us. That's an excerpt from the overture to Idomeneo, King of Crete, by Mozart. You can attend a lavish Opera San Jose production from the comfort of your own screening room at home and on an evening of your choice now through the 18th of May. And best of all, you don't have to dress up for the occasion or tip your waiter. I guess that's good for you, but bad for your waiter. We're hurting now through all that, of course. But here to talk about this lavish 2011 production of Mozart's Idomeneo, jointly produced with the Packard Humanities Institute, is Corey Dastour, who was appointed general director of Opera San Jose last year and will launch her first season at the helm this year into 2021. Although new in this particular post, she's been affiliated with Opera San Jose since joining its resident ensemble of principal artists back in 2007 under the tutelage of founder Irene Dallas. She enjoyed a vibrant international opera career as a lyric soprano and then turned her talents, this California native, to arts administration in 2012. Welcome, Corey, to Open Air.
Thank you, David. Thank you for having me.
Well, it would be nice to see you in person, but we're seeing you in person in a sort of way.
Right. We'll take a rain check on that.
Indeed. So before we talk about this production of Idomeneo, let's talk about what's happening with the company itself, both on the artistic side and on the administrative side.
Sure. I think like many of our colleague organizations, we're taking things one day at a time. Probably refreshing our local news a little bit more often per day than is healthy. But what we're really focusing on is what is our mission? Our mission is to be an operatic incubator for emerging talent. And even though the particular circumstances of this pandemic are restricting the way that we deliver our programming to our patrons, we are trying to focus on how we continue to support artists. How are we able to be a life raft for the people that make our company great? And we are having a lot of brainstorming sessions about what the coming months might look like, how we might change the way we deliver programming to our patrons. And this streaming of Idomeneo is a good example of that.
Well, this obviously has a big financial impact on the company itself, this crisis, and a heck of a time for you to come in as a general director. A position of which always is putting out fires of some sort of another. And right. Now you've got to deal with this whole COVID-19 crisis.
Well, I'm also homeschooling two young children. So, you know, it's every day is an adventure.
I think this will be picked up on my mic, my slapping my forehead.
But, you know, the team is incredible. It's not just a devastating blow to us, but we're really just reeling from being divorced from the way that we cope. We can't gather. We can't have collective experience in the same way. So yes, it's a tragedy, of course, for the opera company, but it's also just revealed the parts of our humanity and how we need to come together now more than ever in order to get through this.
Mm-hmm. There has to be some serious conversations as well about a timeline. And there's no practical way to talk about a timeline for reopening at this point.
Well, I think the timeline is really an unhelpful way to spend energy. What's more helpful is to think about assuming the current situation is going to be with us for a while. How do we adapt our mission instead? And what are those projects that maybe we couldn't consider because of the realities of a huge opera venue or the realities of needing to sell 6,000 tickets and produce something in the California theater? What are those projects that were maybe sort of not under consideration that now can maybe provide exactly the right solution that would be artistically interesting, that would serve our mission? So I'm actually, after having about a two-week temper tantrum, I'm coming around to sort of being inspired by some of those projects and hearing from artists about what they would like to work on in the months to come.
Mm-hmm. And contractually speaking, obviously contracts have been in place for the current season. Musicians have had to have been engaged. How is the company dealing with that financial end of things?
So we've never canceled a production in our 40-year history. Even during the earthquake, we went on. We had a power outage during a performance of Hansel and Gretel. The show went on. So it was quite a stunning day on March 11th when I had to make the heartbreaking decision to walk into a rehearsal and cancel our production of The Magic Flute, which would have opened last Saturday.
And that would have been with Donato Cabrera making his debut, I believe.
Indeed. We had a fine cast of singers, wonderful creative team, had flown from all over the world. And of course, as you know, and your listeners will know, operas are complicated undertakings, years in the planning. So to walk in on day two, which would have been the second rehearsal, and make the announcement that in the interest of our patron safety, we were canceling the full production was truly an incredible, surreal experience. And in doing so, I knew that I was affecting the lives of about 185 employees and announcing the loss of over $500,000 in wages.
That's a big heavy burden.
It was. And so at the same moment, we launched the Opera San Jose Artist Relief Fund, which has been our way of offering some relief to the people who were counting on that employment during this period. And I'm very happy to say we've seen a very broad public response to that. And we continue to be able to serve our resident company, musicians, craftspeople, costume shop staff, scene shop staff through those generously donated funds.
And we can point people to operasj.org for more information on that, as well as this exciting production that you're going to be live streaming. Let's talk about how you chose this particular production to use, and it's how it fell into your lap at the right time in terms of being able to stream.
Yeah, so it's not a live stream. It's a 2011 audiovisual capture of a live performance. And it was what you would call a no-brainer. It was just this incredible black swan event is how I describe it to people. David W. Packard from the Packard Humanities Institute, a noted classicist, teamed up with our founder, Irene Dallas, to create this version of his favorite opera. Or maybe actually, no. I think his favorite opera is The Marriage of Figaro, but certainly Mozart is his favorite composer. And his scholarship and Irene's production prowess really comes together in this incredibly opulent production. And it was one of those things that has been a proud moment in our history, an artistic pinnacle. David was wise enough back then in 2011 to make sure it would be captured properly. And so we've been We've had this footage in our vaults since then, and we thought now was the right time to share it, not only with our patrons, but with the world while we're all home.
And conducted by the late, great Mozart interpreter George Glief.
Yes, as you were playing the overture, I was just in my mind's eye watching George conduct and thinking how incredible the Opera San Jose Orchestra sounded on that night.
Tell us more about the production. It's being described all over the press release as lavish.
Well, sure. That's because there's 90 performers that come together. And you'll remember we used to have a beautiful ballet company in San Jose. So at the end of the opera, we enjoy seeing 18, the full court of ballet. You'll recognize some names that back then weren't so famous, such as tenor Aaron Blake, who just had a huge success in Akhenaten at the Metropolitan Opera, singing Prince Idamante here very early in his career. The production is set with Minoan references and frescoes and taken from ancient Minoan art. So it's a feast for the eyes as well as the ears.
Fantastic. And it's going to be available through the 18th of May at through the Opera SJ website or through?
That's right. It'll be hosted on our website through the 18th of May and then available forever after on Vimeo.
Fantastic. Let's talk a little bit about what you are planning in a positive way for Opera San Jose in the coming season.
Sure. It's a little strange to know what to say, but I can share what we have been working on. We plan to open our season with a reframing of my favorite opera, The Marriage of Figaro, told through the lens of colonial India, where the Count and Countess are transported into a land where they become the other. Then we're very excited to welcome Taylor in her role debut as Carmen in one of the most beloved operas of all time. Our Richard Strauss premiere, we've never done a Strauss work before. We are excited to be working on Salome. And we will conclude the season with a beautiful production of West Side Story.
Nice. Well, let's keep our fingers crossed for all of that. And we'll applaud the efforts of the 2011 production of Mozart's Idomeneo from the comfort of our own home. Corey Dastur is...
Oh, sorry. I just wanted to mention...
Please.
From our website, we've also launched OSJ at Home, lots of content and virtual concerts as we celebrate Mozart this month. So I'd welcome your listeners to visit us there.
Thanks, Corey, for joining us. Corey Dastur, General Director of Opera San Jose.
Thank you so much.
Of course. OperaSJ.org for more information about the production of Mozart's Idomeneo, the 2011 lavish production from Opera San Jose, available thanks jointly produced with the Packard Humanities Institute, and something that you can see in the comfort of your own home in your private screening room until May 18th. Also at operasj.org, learn more about the musicians and the artistic relief fund that they got going for their company and people associated with the group. I'm very pleased to welcome back to the KLW studios, at least virtually, Eric Zivian and Tanya Tompkins. Eric, let's start with Tanya. Tanya's been... is a cellist who performs both Baroque and modern versions of the instruments. She's artistic director and co-founder of the Valley of the Moon Music Festival in Sonoma. She's performed on many chamber music series to critical acclaim around the country and for the past 20 years. She has been one of San Francisco's Philharmonia Baroque Orchestra and Portland Baroque Orchestra's principal cellists and has appeared with both numerous times as a soloist. Among other canceled groups and performances, she's a member of the Left Coast Chamber Ensemble. Her life and musical partner, music director, and co-founder of the Valley of the Moon Music Festival is Eric Zivian, acclaimed piano interpreter in both historic and modern versions of that instrument. He is also a member of the Left Coast Chamber Ensemble, and it's a pleasure to welcome them both back to open air. Eric, Tanya, welcome. Thanks for zooming in.
Oh, thanks for having us back.
Nice to see you, David.
Of course. Yeah. Well, you know, I'm sure plans for this year's Valley of the Moon Music Festival are very much in flux.
Absolutely. Just as we just heard from Corey, we're rolling with the punches here and thinking of different ways of doing what we really want to do by having a festival. We love bringing everybody together around music. We love promoting young musicians, all of those things. And how can we continue to do that this summer, whether we do it as planned or in other creative ways? That's what we're busy with all the time here now.
Okay, we're going through a process right now in the next couple of weeks of examining our options and trying to figure out what we're going to do. If we do any public concerts, we imagine it's going to be for quite small audiences, and we'll have to see what the health regulations provide and take care of everybody in the best possible way. And if it's not possible to do that, we'll do live streaming from our usual venue or from our own homes, or there's many different options that we're going to explore, and then we're going to make some decisions about how to proceed.
As I talked with Corey about the contractual obligations, obviously you have people in place already for this year's festival, and how are they being taken care of?
Yes, well, we're a smaller organization, and we arrange things more closer to the time of the event, so we hadn't sent out our contracts yet. But we did decide that it was really important for us to take care of our musicians in our musical community. We had some money in the bank, a little bit, not a huge amount, but a little bit. And we decided that it was important for us to send out our contracts right away and to give all of our musicians half of their fees, no matter what happens. And so we had them sign their contracts and just let them know we're not sure what's going to happen, but they're going to get half of their fees no matter what. And if we end up doing something, they'll get the rest of it then. And we were happy to be able to do that. Our board was happy to support us in that idea. We want to continue to, consistent with our ability to exist as an organization over the next few years, we want to take care of our people as well as possible. And so that's our way of doing that.
That's very, I'm searching for a word here. Noble comes to mind. Thank you for doing that for the musicians. It's very, very good. Have you thought of some sort of contingency plan, depending on how things are opened up in the weeks and months ahead?
Yeah, I mean, the festival that we had planned in July was going to be a fabulous celebration of the 250th anniversary of Beethoven. So there's a lot of silence in the world around Beethoven right now. There were going to be so many live concerts of it, of course. And what we were going to explore this summer was all the other composers' responses and reactions to Beethoven, whether it was just feeling crippled with sort of awe or inspired to be as good as. So we were going all the way up to John Cage, and the quote from John Cage is basically, Beethoven was wrong. He was so attached to narrative and expectation, setting up expectation and fulfilling that in time and music. And of course, John Cage just throws a big wrench in that, you know, to the point of even having absolute silence as a piece. So we went all the way up to that in our programming. And we started with C.P.E. Bach, who was a huge influence on Beethoven with all of his incredible eccentric creativity in music, kind of breaking the rules and everything and making classical music completely different. And I think Beethoven took that lineage and really took it to the nth degree. But if we can't do all of that programming as we planned, it would involve flying in a lot of people, lecturers, which we can probably still have the lecturers because that's easy to do virtually. But there are so many amazing local musicians here that are also involved in our festival. If we can't fly in our apprentices, we have an apprenticeship program. We just accepted 5 incredibly talented musicians. Most of them are in New York or one is in Canada. I mean, they would have to fly in and stay places. So if we have to defer that program, we can use really interesting musicians around here to try and duplicate at least a lot of chamber music for people and talking about this theme and thinking about it with people through lectures, through live streaming, through perhaps smaller things. So that's, as Eric said, that's what we're busy working on right now.
Right. And ordinarily tickets would have gone on sale already. We've suspended that process. We're thinking about various possibilities. Like, as I said, if we had a very small audience that could be consistent with social distancing, spaced out in the hall, or if that's not possible, can we live stream from the hall? Or if that's not possible, can we live stream from somewhere else? And we could do some of our material from this summer in a different way, or we could do different material this summer and then have the festival we planned for this summer next summer. And we don't know which of those things we're going to do, but we're going to be deciding all that pretty soon.
We're really lucky because we have this outstanding recording engineer, Bobby Borisov, who came right at the beginning of the lockdown. He dropped off on our porch a bunch of really fancy equipment where we can actually live stream from our living room. You know, we sanitized it and brought it in, and he had to like tell us how to hook it up. And of course, we're like technologically not very good. So that was an interesting process. But we now are set up in our living room to be able to live stream. And we have all these beautiful historic instruments here. We can do that. Beethoven is very present in our house. We're here sheltered in place together, Eric and I, which is really lucky. We have each other and we have our instruments. And every morning I come downstairs to Beethoven being furiously practiced on the piano, because right now Eric is learning all 32 sonatas. That's a way to keep busy during this time.
And it's also content that we're going to be experimenting with delivering, something we're calling Beethoven Delivered. It was an idea we had pre-COVID a little bit. We were going to actually take the piano, the little piano that we have, the antique piano, to people's houses. Now we'll just record it here and deliver it to them live in their own living rooms.
And so it's on command. People can choose their favorite Beethoven sonata, and then we can live stream it into their living room. All that information is on our website at valleyofthemoonmusicfestival.org.
Include a link to Domino's Pizza or something so they can order a pizza at the same time they order your music.
Deliver the pizza and Beethoven all at the same time.
And I do all the cello sonatas too.
Yes, we're also doing all the cello sonatas that can be delivered. Other things that we're doing right now that are also available on our website that are immediate things are, as soon as this happened, I just had this need to reach out to all of our musicians, and I have been interviewing them all. Some really interesting interviews are coming out of that. Tomorrow's interview, the series is called Fermata Fridays. So Fermata being the sort of big pause in music, which we're in right now in life. And so tomorrow's interview will be with Monica Huggett, who's one of early music's huge pioneers and who did a lot of paving the road for all of us who decided to do classical music on historic instruments. And I think it's an amazing interview. It's one of the silver linings that we have time to try something different like this, to really get to know a musician intimately and personally. She tells an incredible story in this interview about one of the first historic performance recordings of the Beethoven symphonies with the Hanover Band in London in the 80s. And it is an incredible story. You also get to hear that recording, which is a groundbreaking recording and absolutely stunning. She's leading it from the violin. And they're all kind of intriguing situations going on, including, I shouldn't give them away. But anyway, if you're interested in that interview, it's available on our website. We send it out every Friday for Fermata Fridays. I'm also, I've done an interview with Nick McGeegan that I'm really excited about as well. He says a lot of interesting things. I've also done a lot of interviews with some of our younger laureates and apprentices, and they talk about where they are. One of them was in quarantine in Italy in his parents' basement, and he had his upright piano there to keep him company. Each of these stories has turned out to be really fascinating and a wonderful way for us to stay connected and to keep our audiences connected with our musicians during this time.
Making musical lemonade out of lemons, Tanya Tompkins,
exactly.
And Eric Zivian of the Valley of the Moon Music Festival. Valley of the Moon Music Festival, spell it all out, .org for more information on what you're doing. Fermata Fridays, tomorrow's a Friday, tune in. And we do have an example of, occurred to me that maybe for the festival you can find enough households like yourself that have two musical people in it that can create less social distancing on a stage than would normally be possible if you had to be 6 feet away from each other.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think we can even add a violinist here at a certain point, because we can make music with them even from 6 feet apart.
Right. And also, if they relax the restrictions slightly, but not very much, all sorts of things will become possible in the house at least. Yeah, so.
Nice. Let's hear Eric and Tanya in a bit of Beethoven. Here's an excerpt from the Piano and Cello Sonata No. 1. Thanks again for being with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
After a break with some music here, we'll talk with Joshua Cosman, music critic of the San Francisco Chronicle, and Peter Robinson will be by to share some classic movie musicals for your in-home enjoyment. This is Open Air on KALW. An excerpt from the Beethoven Piano and Cello Sonata No. 1 from the living room of Eric Zivian, Tanya Tompkins, piano and cellist, respectively directors of the Valley of the Moon Music Festival. Learn about their Fermata Fridays at valleyofthemoonmusicfestival.org. Their favorite Shakespeare, by the way, Eric's fond of King Lear, and Tanya mentioned the Tempest Sonata of Beethoven. A very good afternoon to you once again. I'm David Latulippe here with Open Air, KLW's now virtual radio magazine of the performing arts. From the comfort of my studio and the comfort of his home studio is Joshua Cosman, the music critic of the San Francisco Chronicle and not an infrequent guest panelist for Minds Over Matter. Hi, Joshua.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me here.
So what are you doing? Anything?
Well, you know, it's hard. We're all... like everybody else, we're at the Chronicle, we're kind of reinventing our jobs on the fly and trying to figure out what kinds of things we can do to keep people informed at a time when there's actually not all that much of what we're used to as far as cultural activity is concerned. So when this first came down, why we spent a lot of time just compiling a list of canceled events. And that was a real bummer. And at some point, we just sort of took it for granted that everything was canceled unless otherwise notified. And so we're looking around to see what kinds of things people are doing to keep art and music and theater and dance alive during these terrible times. This past Sunday, we had a big section in the Pink Section about. With some vignettes of what local artists are doing to keep their creative spirits going. We had a variety of different kinds of writing projects and dance projects. And Sid Chen, who's a local singer, who's been making wonderful little music boxes with hand-punched paper rolls to execute all kinds of musical offerings from Bach to the theme of Schitt's Creek. So, you know, it all keeps going in some form or another.
Right. And it really is truly bringing out the part of people's brains that are artistic and creative because they hit out of necessity.
Exactly so.
Can you really criticize something that you see virtually online, though, in terms of an actual critical experience?
No, mean, I haven't written, a performance review since the pandemic began. The Left Coast Chamber Ensemble had a concert right after the shelter in place order came down, and they said, well, it was a small ensemble of performers, so it wasn't like a big orchestra where everybody had to stay far apart. They got a few people in the room, and they did a live stream in front of an empty hall at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music, and that was kind of a novelty at the time. This is early March. We've seen a lot more of those kinds of undertakings since then. So I wrote about that in a kind of a live streamy way, but it certainly wasn't. It wasn't. An assessment of the musical qualities as much as it was a sense of, what kind of world is this that we're now living in? And a report on the experience of hearing music and listening to music that's being played in a giant empty hall. It was very strange. Mm-hmm. It turns out that applause is the big factor, is, an absolutely essential part of any musical event.
Sure. And I talked with this with friends as well, and it's not so much applause as affirmation and needing that for your personal satisfaction, but it's a communal thing, and it does show a connection that is lost otherwise.
Yeah, absolutely. And it turns out it's also a punctuation mark. You don't really know that the piece is over if it just fades away into silence. I mean, I guess if it was Beethoven's Fifth or something, there would be no doubt. But other pieces, you kind of take your cue from the fact that the audience starts to applaud, and you say, well, that experience has come to an end.
Right. You don't have to worry. I was going to say, you don't have to worry about coughing in an audience hall, but you really shouldn't be worrying about coughing in an audience.
Oh, yes.
Take that back. I mean, with your crystal ball, do you see a time that people will feel comfortable in a performing hall with woodwinds breathing down the violin's back and the radiator that is a French horn dribbling on the percussion?
I don't know what to say to that, David. I have no crystal ball. I have no epidemiological expertise of any kind. So, you know, I hesitate to make any kind of predictions. Some days I wake up thinking this will be over soon. We'll have music and our hearts again. And other mornings I think, this is never going to end. This, you know, our entire lives are going to be divided into before and after. And neither of those predictions is worth anything. It's just what side of the bed I wake up on in the morning.
Right. I'm thinking too that perhaps a concert hall could be configured so people are appropriately socially distanced. And I think that might be the first steps as things are going on. But the sheer numbers that have been bandied about are just daunting. 40 million people, I believe, in California. If the governor's projection of getting 60,000 tests a day are realized, that's 666 days before everyone's tested.
Okay.
So,
you know, I have no expertise, as I say, to bring to bear on this point, and I think I'm probably just as well to stay out of it. What I will say is that I think, you know, we may see a shift in the kinds of musical and cultural events that we see and that we hear, just because already you're seeing that, you know, music for one, two, three performers has a big leg up on music for 100 orchestral players, which is worrisome, but also interesting. You know, it may be the case that a new kind of musical expectation will arise, you know, in which chamber music and contemporary music get a kind of a reprieve, I hope. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. And are you starting to revisit some things like MTT's series Keeping Score?
I have, you know, off and on. A lot of these things are, you know, are around and about, and the kind of catalog of concert halls or the Metropolitan Opera broadcasts that go out every night. But, you know, everybody's sitting on these sort of troves of recorded cultural expression in the absence of anything newly created or produced. So, you know, we're a little bit, you know, like, I don't know what's the, you know, we're cave dwellers or something, you know, sitting on our troves of gold and counting them over again and again and hoping that they'll last until we can come out into the sunshine.
Yeah, well, I know it's given you some time to pursue some other passions. I know that in addition to Minds Over Matter, you're quite a gamester. And...
Puzzles and crossword puzzles and word puzzles, number puzzles of all kinds are kind of my other big enthusiasm in life. I wrote a big section for this coming Sunday's Pink section, which is online today, about puzzles and crosswords and other kinds of puzzles, including a couple of newly created puzzles that will be in the print section on Sunday, if you get the Sunday paper. Later this afternoon at 4 o'clock, we're going to do a live video chat for Chronicle subscribers with my editor, Mari Carmendoza, and Henry Picciotto, who's my collaborator on the weekly cryptic crossword puzzle that we write that used to run in The Nation magazine until last month and now is available online for subscription. You can find information about that at leftfieldcryptics.com.
Fantastic. Yeah. We were talking about Shakespeare earlier. This is the anniversary in 1616 of his death on Sunday. It's his birthday, so it's kind of a Shakespeare-y kind of week. What does Shakespeare mean in your life? Oh, I already asked the question, but I need, since we were talking about games, I don't suppose you're a Bananagrams fan, are you?
Not particularly.
Okay, because I'm working on a Zoom version of that. Just
Yeah. All right. Well, there are websites that you can find where you can play games like that, where it'll virtually. There's a wonderful game, party game called Codenames, which has been a runaway success over the last few years, a word guessing game, kind of like Password, but much more interesting. And my family, my extended family, my parents, my brothers, all the nieces and nephews and cousins have been playing that together on family gatherings for years. And we have taken to now playing it every Sunday. We get together on Zoom and there's a website that does the mechanics for you.
So what is that site?
It'll family be a, visiting be great, time and some game time all at once.
That'll be a great service. What is it to our listeners? What is that site?
It's called netgames.io, and there's
netgames
netgames.io. I'm not familiar with that top level extension, but there it is. Mm-hmm. And they have a couple of other games, Werewolf and I forget what else. We always play Codenames because that's our faves.
Nice. All right. Well, on to Shakespeare.
Shakespeare for me, I have to say, I mean, go Shakespeare, but I'll always take my Shakespeare sort of through the veins of composers, primarily Verdi. I think, the two late Shakespeare operas, Othello and Falstaff, are among the really great translations of Shakespeare onto the stage and sort of unparalleled. And the only problem with those two operas is that, for me at least, they kind of dull my pleasure in the original plays, because the wealth of Verdi's musical language in those last two operas is so rich and so evocative, and I feel like I can't quite just do the plays without them after a certain point.
Mm, you mentioned Othello, the end of the first act especially.
Well, yeah, I have to say I came to Othello a little bit late. I don't know why. I had not discovered it before, and I was already in my early 20s when I discovered it for the first time, and I kind of went bananas. I became one of those people who was running around the streets going, like, trying to virtually grab people by their lapels and say, "Have you heard about Othello? Mm-hmm. I need to preach to you about Othello," because I couldn't believe how good it was and how fluid the musical dramaturgy was and how rich the emotional content of it was. So we had talked about listening to the love duet from the end of Act One, which is sort of the part where I went, "Oh my God, I can't believe what I'm hearing."
Here's Placido Domingo and Cheryl Studer singing that love duet. Josh, thanks for taking some time today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.
We'll see you again soon, I hope.
You bet.
some favorite Shakespeare of Joshua Cosman in operatic form from the end of the first act of Verdi's Otello. A very good afternoon to you. I'm David LaTulipe, here with, how about a Shakespeare-related pun? I think Josh was fond of puns, so he might enjoy this. Favorite Shakespeare. Okay, it's the time of Julius Caesar. The great Mark Antony is his counsel, of course, but he's also acting as tax collector and makes sure that when people have businesses in the great Roman Empire, the tribute is paid or they're going to take their stuff back. So Mark Antony hears of a vegetable patch that has been growing these incredibly large strawberries, and he also learns that the brothers that are operating it have not been paying tax. So there's this long line of people waiting to see the berry, and the brothers sight Mark Antony there at the end of the line. Said, "Oh, Mark, you came to see the berry, didn't you?" And the brother chimes in, "Yeah, you want to see the berry?" And Mark Antony says, "Friends, Romans, countrymen, I came to seize your berry, not to praise it." On that note.
Getting to like you, getting to hope you like me. Getting to know you, putting it my way, but nicely. You are precisely my cup of tea. Getting to know you, getting to feel
The King and I, one of Peter Robinson's suggested musicals for your COVID quarantine. Hi, Peter.
Hi, David. Yeah, good to be with you. And I've been taking a trip down a musical memory lane. And what I've found at times like this is that some of the old familiar tunes are sometimes the most comforting. And in the age of Zoom, the reason I like getting to know you is that obviously I've been on Zoom with friends, some I know well, some I know reasonably. And the process, in fact, has increased that quality of literally getting to know people and know them in a different type of way. And I took part in a BBC conference where they were calling correspondents from around the world last week. And one of the things we took from Zoom is that you can see the person, you can hear the person, but you cannot, of course, touch the person. And it made me think that sometimes with Zoom connections, you get moments of silence. And they always say silence is golden, except on the radio. And people are having a hard time waiting for the other person on Zoom to come in. So sometimes those silences are uncomfortable. And one lady I worked with in Australia, in Sydney, was on, and she was explaining that the only time she ever put makeup on and did her hair was when she was going on to Zoom. So I suddenly realized that the top half of your body on a Zoom contact becomes really important. In fact, Walmarts are claiming they're selling more tops now than any other type of clothing. But to go back to this tune, which I really like, it's a storytelling tune, of course, coming out of that great musical, The King and I, which in many ways was an interesting cultural exchange, because in Thailand, the king was then, still is, respected as a kind of divine right of kings, and it was almost considered wrong to have him singing and dancing with the key other character played by Deborah Kerr, in which she is the teacher of the children. But in many ways, the lyrics, again, they speak for themselves. It's a great Rodgers and Hammerstein piece of collaboration. And they use some of the right words. You are my cup of tea. And considering she's an English tutor, that, of course, works well. So this is a good example of what I call the golden age of Hollywood musicals. And getting to know you, I think, is as relevant today as it was when it was first written in 1951 and then turned into a movie in 1958. It's a tune that you can hum along to. It's a tune that warms your heart. It's a tune about connecting. It's a tune about understanding. It's a tune about teaching. It's a tune that brings people together. And at this particular time, in our particular world, I think that is one of the most important human and spiritual connections.
Indeed. Peter, such wonderful tunes from that show. I Whistle a Happy Tune. We could all be doing that. Hello, Young Lovers. We Kiss in a Shadow, Something Wonderful, Shall We Dance, such wonderful, great
music. Yeah, and I think you're right about talking about dance, because there is that great sequence with Yolbrella, which actually lasts quite a long time, and is an example of a king being drawn into a social, in this case, dancing situation. And talking about dance, that has been my second connection. And this time I'm going back to what for people is like ancient history. The year is 1938. The music is by Irving Berlin. And the film is called Follow the Fleet. And, of course, it's that great sequence with Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. And I'm going to say a little bit about the lyrics, which I think are important, if we could first hear the music. And the music that I'm thinking of is, of course, that dance sequence, Let's Face the Music and Dance.
Let's hear a little bit of that, Peter, before we talk about your third selection.
Mm-hmm.
There may be trouble ahead, but while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance. Before the fiddlers have played, before they ask us to pay the bill, and while we still have the chance, let's face the music and dance. Soon we'll be without the moon, humming a different tune. And then there may be teardrops to shed. So while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance, dance, let's face the music.
The great Fred Astaire and Let's Face the Music and Dance. A great selection, Peter.
To flow. So that, again, has conjured up important memories of how the silver screen in today's world can be translated into something that has meaning in 2020. And for the same reason that we want to escape, we want to move from the living room to something bigger and something wider. And I think it comes down to those wonderful lyrics. So my last piece of music, which again is part of this trip, a musical memory lane trip, is from the show Annie Get Your Gun. And Annie Oakley was the key character. She in real life had been a sharpshooter in the circus of Buffalo Bill. And this particular tune, which has got the key title, There's No Business Like Show Business, I think is what we all need in terms of keeping the show on the road. Again, everything about this lyric, I think, speaks to the now. Everything about it is appealing, everything that traffic will allow. Nowhere could you lose that happy feeling when you see them stealing another bow. So that idea that the stage brings to life another part of our entertainment business, where there's dancing, there's history, because Annie Oakley was a sharpshooter, a real person. Buffalo Bill, indeed, was a real person. And interestingly enough, when the show was rewritten in 1951, they had to change some of the lyrics to make it more sensitive to Native Americans. So it's a good example of how history catches up with the world of Broadway. And to me, it always brings that happy feeling, and we indeed have to let's go on with the show. So the repetitive line in that, enforces and endorses where the music is taking us. So my last piece for this week is There's No Business Like Show Business. Next week I'm going to be exploring how, say, Bernard Shaw's play Pygmalion got turned into My Fair Lady. And again, we'll be hearing some great music from another, in this case, 1950-1960 classic. But let's hear and let's dance to, let the mind wander, let's go out with There's No Business Like Show Business.
You should mention that tune is from Annie Get Your Gun, but also from the repurposed in the Irving Berlin musical There's No Business Like Show Business from 1954, starring Ethel Merman, Dan Daly, Donald O'Connor, Marilyn Monroe, and Hugh O'Brien. Donald O'Connor called it one of his favorite musicals. Here is the great Ethel Merman. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you, David. Good to be with you.
Show business like no business I know. Everything about it is appealing. Everything the traffic will allow. Nowhere could you get that happy feeling when you are stealing that extra bow. There's no people like show people. They smile when they are low. Yesterday they told you you would not go. You open, and there you are. Next day on your dressing room, they've hung a star. Let's go on with the show. The costumes, the scenery, the makeup, the props, the audience that lifts you when you're down. The headaches, the heartaches, the backaches, the flops, the sheriff who escorts you out of town. The opening when your heart beats like a drum. The closing when the customers don't come. There's no business like no business, like no business I know. You get word before the show has started that your favorite uncle died at dawn. And top of that, your father might have parted. You're brokenhearted, but you go on. There's no people like no people. They smile when they are low. Even with a turkey that you know will fold, you may be stranded out in the cold. Still, you wouldn't change it for a sack of gold.
From There's No Business Like Show Business, as well as Annie Get Your Gun, the great Ethel Merman. Great escape film for your watching pleasure at home. If you're cooped up, you need an escape. That's Open Air for Thursday, April 23rd, 2020. I'm David LaTulipe, lonely in the studio of KALW, normally joined by my guests. Thanks to Zoom, we get to see a couple of them, but more importantly, you're hearing them. And you're hearing how they're dealing with this COVID-19 crisis and the creative ways that they're getting by. Thanks always to Neil Swinkles for producing the show. And if you've got an example of some creative artistry going on in your neck of the woods, send me an email, david@kalw.org. We'll consider it for a segment here on Open Air. Archived at kalw.org with links to everything you've heard today. Thanks so much for being with us.